Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Dr. Martin Goldman, who is both a dentist and an Alexander Technique teacher. Dr. Goldman has been a dentist for, I believe, over 30 years, and recently, in the last year, he has completed a three-year training course to become an Alexander teacher. And we've had a previous conversation revolving around treatment for TMJ, and we'll put a mention where that interview is. And today we're going to address ourselves to dentists, dental hygienists, dental assistants, and more broadly, anyone who has to work in somewhat uncomfortable or odd positions doing precise work. And since I know Dr. Goldman personally, I'm going to call him Martin. Martin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity, Bob. I'm really anxious to talk about two of my real passions here, dentistry and Alexander Technique.
Well, I think now most of our listeners have some idea of what dentistry is all about. But I think the majority of them are not going to know what the Alexander Technique is. So could you give them a very short description definition of the Alexander Technique?
Right. The Alexander Technique is a 100-year-old method for streamlining how you perform day-to-day activities, and it provides a way to let go of unnecessary muscular tension and to allow free and open movement while you're making just your everyday activities. And this is particularly relevant for dentists or anyone working in the dental field, and anyone who also works at a profession which requires repetitive movements done from a fixed postural attitude.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there have been quite a few personal accounts by people who have benefited from the Alexander Technique in other fields, but we don't really have a lot from the field of dentistry. Maybe you could start by saying what is it about dentistry that makes it so tricky from a postural point of view?
Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. I want to start off by saying dentistry is just a wonderful profession, but it can be a really tough way to make a living. I came across a statistic the other day, which is quite telling. There was a 1997 Dental Association survey that reported that 9.2% of dentists had been diagnosed by a physician as having some type of repetitive motion disorder. And within this group who were diagnosed as having repetitive motion disorder, approximately 20% required surgery, and more than 40% shortened their work hours. So I know that's sometimes listening to statistics can be deadening, but if you think of it in terms of one in every 10 dentists had severe enough symptoms that made them pursue seeing a physician, there's a vast number of guys and women who are working through pain that might come and go, or just the exigencies of making a living, you know, makes them tough it out, even though they're in agony. What leads to this? I realized after I had an active 30-year practice for as being a dentist, and I thought that coming home after a long day with sore, aching back and shoulders as tight as piano wire was just part of the game. You know, I tried acupuncture, I tried various exercise regimens, yoga, and they would give some relief for a period of time, but the pain would seem to always come back sooner or later. And I now realize that it wasn't so much what I was doing, as how I was doing it, which was the important issue. Dentists, or those working chair side, are habitually they're seated, and to address the patient, they have to come down and usually to the left if you're a right-handed person, and to be downward directed and unilaterally collapsed can lead to all kinds of woes up and down the spine.
Mm-hmm. So for starters, dentists and people working in that field are subjecting themselves, just by the nature of their occupation, to some pretty unusual risk factors, you might say.
I think so, yes. Most dental procedures last anywhere from an hour to more complex procedures, 3 or 4 hours even. And it can be quite intense to be in a held position doing precise, minute activity. And what I'd like to suggest is that there's a different way to do this from a more open, easy attitude. And I have some tips that might be useful for a dentist looking retrospectively back at how I used to practice. I'm actually still an active licensed dentist doing specific procedures. And boy, it's made, I feel better now than I did 30 years ago, which is quite an amazing thing to be able to say. And I'm thankful to the Alexander Technique for being able to say that.
So do you have a few very specific suggestions that someone could explore on their own? Is that right?
Yes, yes. And I'd also like to add that these suggestions that I might add, they can be amplified by going through these ideas and thoughts and directions with an Alexander teacher who is trained to help you experience, not just talk about how to be open and free in your postural attitudes, but can also give you a direct experiential idea of what that might feel like. So it's like adding a catalyst. It's pretty tough to try and do these things on your own, although it's probably going to be helpful, but you can really just supercharge your efforts by doing it in conjunction with an Alexander Technique teacher.
Okay, well, let's have a couple of procedures.
Well, the first thing I want to talk about is might sound a little bit airy-fairy or new age, but believe me, this has practical applications, and had practical applications in my own career as a dentist. This is something that I think you could do, in fact I would urge you to do, before you enter the operatory. You've got time to do this, even if you're running behind on your schedule. You know, if you've got patients lined up in your waiting room, and you don't have to rush in and get busy. Pause for a moment outside the operatory and get yourself what we call organized. And the way to do this, I'm going to give you three instructions. We call them primary directions. And I want you to think of this, I can only talk about this one at a time, you know, one after the other. But actually, as you become more adept in doing this, it'll be almost like playing a chord on a piano. These things can happen for you simultaneously, as well as one after the other. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is the thought that my neck is free. Just having that thought, saying, my neck isn't pulled down, has amazing implications. The second thing to think about would be, once my neck is free, my head can float up and forward off of the top of my spine. And then the third thing is, if my neck is free and my head floats forward and up, my back will lengthen and widen reflexively, and you can assume your full stature. To do this before you enter the operatory leads you to a balanced, open way of coming into the operatory. If you can make this a practice to pause for a moment, gather yourself, allow my neck to be free so my head floats forward and up, my back lengthening and widening, walk into the operatory, and usually the patient is sitting in the chair you usually approach from behind in most dental operatory schemes, and that patient sitting in the chair knows he's going to be touched, and often his expectations are not exactly positive. A lot of dental patients are really quite apprehensive, and what I'd like you to do, just give it a try, is once you come into the operatory, after giving yourself a moment to become what we call organized, and be able to give a just a touch in a neutral way with a neutral hand, not requiring anything from the patient, but just in a gesture of friendship, that has such an amazing effect on the aura that's in the room. I don't need you to keep your hand on the shoulder, but just an initial touch between a practitioner and someone who might be apprehensive will set the mood and will really help you going onward from there.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like to just jump in here. My own dentist always shakes hands with me when he comes in. And I find that very, very reassuring.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, physical contact done in a way that's non-threatening in a situation where somebody might have their fight or flight reflexes engaged can go a long way and for both as benefits both for the patient and for the practitioner. So now you're ready to go to work. So I'd like to give a couple suggestions. Dentistry is done sitting down by the majority of practitioners today, vast majority. You're taught to sit while you're in dental school. And dentistry has given a lot of thought to the ergonomic issue. It's not like this is a foreign subject to them, but I'd like to offer the thought that even the most highly engineered, ergonomically designed chair or a piece of equipment can be defeated by what we call poor use. So I'd like to talk briefly about how it might benefit you if you're working while you're sitting down, how to sit down from what we call a position of mechanical advantage. And let's start by talking about the atlanto-occipital joint. I found that even people in the medical field often have a misconception about where this joint is located. And I'd like to do a little experiment here. I'd like to have whoever's listening, if they wouldn't mind, just play along with this. I'd like you to imagine that down the front of your shirt, there's a row of buttons, if there isn't a row of buttons there already. And I want you to look down at what would be the third button. It's on your lower half of your sternum, you know, on the front of your chest. So just look down at that third button. Now I'd like you to bring your hand to the back of your neck and see if what is called the cervical spine of your neck is engaged while you're looking down. There's a price to be paid if you have to look down at the patient with your neck involved in that activity more than it needs to be. There might be a better way to do this, and I'd like to give you a suggestion about how you might be able, you're going to need to look down and down to the left usually while you're working as a dentist, and there might be an easier way to do this, and I'm going to give you a suggestion how to do that right now. So what I'd like you to do is put your fingers underneath your ears. You can feel a little depression right under your ears. And if you do that with one finger on each side of your head, and then imagine that there's a rod that are connecting your fingers, this rod would pass through what's called the atlanto-occipital joint. And this is the head-neck joint. It's where the head rests atop the spine. If you can visualize that when you look down, that downward motion of the front of your face is going to rotate around this axis, you'll see that looking down then is done from an open attitude. And you can bring this to your work. I hope that word picture was discernible for everybody. Did that make sense to you, Robert?
Yeah, when I show people, students, that, I usually have them put their fingertips at right angles to their head, just pretty much where their ear hole is, or that little flap in front of your ear. I think where you're suggesting is comes to more or less the same place. And what I tell them is imagine a line between your two fingertips and nod your head back and forth, and just know that you're rotating your head around that line. I usually have them do some nodding before so they can have a before and after comparison. And the vast majority of students, even brand new students, will notice immediately that the movement seems freer and easier, and has a more easy range to it. So I think that's what you're getting at, kind of just learning on yourself where that joint is and using it before you engage the rest of the neck, which is available to you, but probably not the best thing to use first.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for amplifying on that.
And if I could just elaborate, so I'm on a roll here. The same thing applies to sideways movements of your head. That is, it's a little trickier. I would ask them to imagine that line running between the two fingertips, and then imagine a vertical axis in the middle, in the midpoint. And when they're turning their head from side to side, just know they're rotating it around that vertical axis. And again, the majority of people, with a little practice, even often right away, are quite amazed by the ease and freedom of movement. And
exactly.
It's really a question of bringing your conception of what the movement is or can be into line with the reality of the structure of your body. And as you pointed out, even most medical professionals who might know this theoretically haven't actually explored it on their own bodies. That's certainly true of doctors that I've worked with, and I would imagine it's true of dentists as well.
I'd like to thank you, Robert. That's just right on. Maybe we can continue with this exercise of how one might sit in a more expansive, energetic way.
Absolutely.
The feet are important. Let's go from one end to the other here. Mm-hmm. And it's good to have some feedback coming from your feet. And let your feet share the load while you're sitting. I know that a lot of dental stools and chairs that dental professionals sit in are highly engineered and might even guide you into some preconceived notion of what might be the ideal way for you to sit. And when I was towards the end of my active practice, I had a chair that was, because I had such back problems, I had a chair that gave really massive lumbar support, and it urged, it was a saddle type seat, and kind of urged me to have my lower back in a supported position. And I realize now that the cure was worse than the disease. What I'd like for people to think about is just the idea of perching. If a, I like that that idea. The more simple the chair you have, I think the better off you are. If you can get some feedback from your feet and what are called the sit bones, that's the, if you can think of rockers at the base of your pelvis, you might even put your hands underneath your seat, your buttocks while you're sitting, and you can easily feel where the prominence is. That's called the sit bones, or it's the height of the ischial tuberosities to be exact. And just as an experiment, you might just roll backwards to and then roll forwards. Anytime you come off the height of your sit bones, then you're introducing muscular tension into the somewhere else in your body and constricting your breathing as well. So if you can sit towards to allow your, it's okay if you move back in your chair, but just don't let the bottom of your thighs be constricted, and sit at the height of your sit bones and let your feet give you some feedback and help share the load. And I think that'll prove beneficial for you.
I think a lot of people in general, and I would imagine this is true of dentists, tend to not actually use their sit bones for support, but are kind of, as you say, falling back on their sacrum, really.
Exactly.
And although visually, if you don't know the anatomy, you might not spot that in somebody else. I think it's it. Once you do that, then you are putting an awful lot of strain on muscles in that area, and you're really increasing the likelihood of back pain for sure. So I think your idea of actually putting your fingers or your hands underneath your bottom and actually feeling those little, there are two of them there, and they're kind of like little rockers. They're perfectly designed for rocking back and forth, rather than sinking down onto your sacrum.
I'd like to talk a little bit now about the shoulder girdle and how at the end we're talking about your arm assembly and how it relates to maybe working in a more comfortable manner for a dental professional. A lot of people don't realize that the arm assembly actually begins at where your collarbone meets your breastbone, where the clavicle meets the sternum. There's actually a joint there. If you can follow your collarbone along towards the midline and then move your arm around, you can feel there's actual movement coming from this. It's actually a joint there, so the sternoclavicular joint. And also, your arm, part of your arm assembly is your help me out here, I'm drawing a blank, for your
shoulder blades.
For the shoulder blades.
Right.
So anyway, I was visualizing couldn't think of the name, but I think it's better if you can think of that assembly without naming the parts, actually, but just know where it begins and ends. Unfortunately for dentists, a lot of times their awareness, because they're working at such minute tasks with their fingers, that their awareness begins and ends at their fingertips. You can think of the beginning of the collarbone clavicular joint and your shoulder blade as being part of your arm and leading out to your shoulder joint and then to your out through your elbow and then out through your fingertips. And I think if a dentist, usually in dental school, they're taught what are called finger rest positions. The dentists and hygienists and assistants in the listening audience will identify with this concept. It's a way to brace your hand so you can have a stable base in which to operate. Just the idea of operating a drill with a sharp bit operating at several hundred thousand RPM in a shaky hand is a scary proposition for all concerned. So they, in dental schools, they teach you a way to provide a stable base, but there's a real trap, there's a real risk in using this base with pressure, because if you press down trying your hardest to provide a stable, so you can move your fingers in 1 millimeter segments, you run a real risk of creating a deadened arm. What I'd like you to think about is having just enough touch in your fingertips to support the instrument and letting directing, we call this directing, it's as if you were pointing with your little finger to direct out the outside of your arm to keep you having the illusion, not only the illusion, but the actuality of maintaining width and breadth as you work. It's a real temptation as you're working to be drawn into your work and to collapse your anterior portion of your body into your work. I'd like whoever is doing the dental work to work with an open arm and a light, with the idea that I don't want to use more pressure than is necessary. Just the concept that I have the possibility of letting loose of the handpiece as well as gripping the handpiece, even if that letting loose isn't actualized. But the idea that I could let loose of this handpiece at any time if I want to is a real boon. It gives you a more balanced psychophysical state. The idea that you're locked into a procedure for X amount of time and I need to finish this procedure to get on to the next thing can lead to constriction and collapse both mentally as well as physically. And the next tip I might like to give is to take a break every now and then. It could be momentary, but change your field of vision. Look up, look away. You know, dentists, I don't know if you're aware of this, Robert, but most dentists work with loops or magnification now. But what that does is it requires you to be at the focal length of approximately 13 inches from the tip of your eye, from the surface of your eyes to the work surface. And what that does is it requires a relatively immobile stance, or else you're going to come out of focus with these magnification glasses.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. You know, I'm certainly aware of those loops.
So to engage your peripheral vision or your far vision every so often during the procedure, get up, stand up for a moment. And it's a real opportunity then. We started off talking about making the patient seem more at ease. It's a great opportunity when you take a momentary break. Ask the patient, how are you doing? Is there anything we can do to make you more comfortable? Give an optimistic progress report. You know, say, we're halfway through and things are going great. You're going to really enjoy having this when we're finished. You know, take a break. It's good for you and it's good for the patient. And then re-engage. Before you re-engage in your task, take a moment to give yourself those three directions again. Check in with your feet, check in with your sit bones, check in with the way you're holding the instrument, then go back to work. It's like taking a vacation, you know, take a mini vacation in the middle of all of this highly directed work.
Well, you know, I think that we're probably coming to the end of our time for this podcast. If we might do a second one with some more suggestions, but what I would like to add to what you've said is just reiterate, first of all, that all of these things are going to be a lot easier if you have at least some experience with an Alexander teacher, because it's a little tricky at times to put these into effect on your own, although I think all of those suggestions that you made would be helpful, but I would see them as giving you a taste of what you could get with a teacher. And the other thing I'd like to add is that everything that we've talked about really applies to a whole range of activities beyond dentistry. And just to cite one example, there's a recent study that was done at the University of Cincinnati Medical School, which involved minimally invasive surgeons who do minimally invasive surgery, some of whom had Alexander lessons and reported that they were better able to do the surgeries and that they were able to do them with greater comfort to themselves. I don't know a lot about minimally invasive surgery, but my understanding is you have to manipulate a kind of a box with little levers and things on it, and it's pretty precise movements, probably somewhat analogous to what a dentist has to do. So there's a huge range of situations in which your suggestions, I think, would be very, very helpful. And if it's okay with you, maybe we could end this podcast, and then if you have more ideas, we could do a second one.
Oh, it'd be...
What do you think?
Endless well.
Okay. Yes. Well, let's end this one now. My guest has been Dr. Martin Goldman, who's has been a dentist for many, many years and has recently trained to become an Alexander Technique teacher. He works in San Francisco East Bay area. We'll put a link to his website next to the interview. And... Martin, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you again, Robert.